When my son Pete was just a little guy, we went to a Pittsburgh Pirates baseball game in Pittsburgh. The Pirates were playing the Nationals. I think in those days the Nats were known as the Expos, but they were playing there, and the game was over. Pirate victory, of course. And Pete and I exited the stadium out of Gate B. We headed back to the parking lot to our car, and as we were going, we were heading there, we were confronted with one of the smelliest, grungiest souls you'd ever expect to see. His clothes were dirty and torn. His hair was greasy and matted. His hands were nicotine stained, and his smile revealed missing and rotted teeth. He held out a sign that read, "I'm homeless. Won't you spare some loose change with me?" I put my hand on Pete's back and escorted him past the guy, hoping he wouldn't say anything to us. Pete, when we were a few yards past the guy, said to me, "I guess we're not going to give him anything, are we, Dad?" I answered, "No. He'd probably spend it on booze or drugs. We give our money to the church and service agencies that take care of the poor." Now, I had not given that bum another thought until last week when I read again this parable of the rich man and Lazarus. My reaction to that man was the same as the rich man to Lazarus. Now, I think I was right not to give him money because he'd waste it. But what would Jesus think? When Jesus tells the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, his audience is comprised of many people, a number of whom were Pharisees. They extol the virtues of following the law and the prophets. And throughout Jesus' ministry, they are repeatedly at odds with him over a variety of issues, not the least of which is the role of money in a righteous person's life. They think Jesus' ideas about money are absurd. The acquisition of wealth, they believe, is a sign of God's blessing. God and money go together, they teach. Obey God, and you will be blessed in war, in the marketplace, in the fields, at home. God is in a league with riches. Prosperity is a sign of God's blessing, and poverty is a sign of God's disfavor. Jesus, however, says, you cannot serve both God and money. Jesus blesses the poor and urges charity toward needy people. He regards the Pharisees' idea as a gross misinterpretation of the law and the prophets, so they never miss an opportunity to attack him. Now, when Jesus confronts the Pharisees and tells this parable, he is using a story form that was a kind of a contemporary story form. It emerges really out of ancient Egypt, and it features two men who die and go to heaven and get involved in a plot with an ironic turnaround. Now, we tell similar stories. It's like the one that I'm sure Jim Greiner can tell better than me, but I'm going to give it a shot anyways. And it's about two baseball players, Jake and Jim, who often discuss whether or not there will be baseball in heaven. They both love baseball so much, and they're sure that life without baseball would be terrible, even in heaven. So they make a deal. They decide that whoever dies first will come back and tell the other one whether or not there's baseball in heaven. One day, Jim dies, and Jake waits patiently for his coming back to him. Day after day goes on, weeks become months, become years go by. Eventually, one night, in a dream, Jim returns to Jake. He announces, "Jake, I've got good news and bad news. The good news is there is baseball in heaven. In fact, I'm playing on a team with Roberto Clemente, Babe Ruth, Whitey Ford, and Bob Feller." And Jake says, "Wow, that is great. What could possibly be the bad news?" He said, "Well, you're pitching for us tomorrow." No doubt you saw that one coming, but it's still funny. Well, Jesus' parable was a similar form to our jokes like that. However, it was not designed to tickle the funny bone. It was designed to poke people in the ribs. In contemporary form, Jesus' parable would go like this. There's a rich guy who has it made in the shade. He has a 25-room mansion, stone mansion, with a long driveway and a gate. His garage is stocked with a Bentley and a Rolls and classic T-Birds and Corvettes. He has a BMW that he drives on rainy days. His backyard includes a sand trap and a putting green right next to the pool and jacuzzi. He employs a masseuse and a personal trainer, as well as a chef who writes a monthly column for Gourmet magazine. His third wife is younger than his daughter. And there is a poor guy. His name is Lazarus. Lazarus eats whenever he can summon up the strength to drag himself to the soup kitchen. His body has red blotches all over it, which are allergic reactions to the bites from fleas that find their home in his hair and flannel shirt. He spends most of his time sitting in front of the rich guy's gate, jangling quarters in a coffee can, holding a sign that says, "I'm homeless. Won't you spare some loose change with me?" The rich guy doesn't mind him sitting there. In fact, he doesn't even notice him anymore. They both die and find themselves in Hades, where the dead hang out. But someone has switched the name tags, changed their seats, because now the rich guy is in agony and Lazarus is quite comfortable. They are within earshot of one another. They're within view, but there's an impassable chasm between the two. The rich guy calls across the chasm to Abraham, who's there, and he says, "Help! It's hotter than hell over here. Send Lazarus over to me with a drink." Abraham replies, "Well, actually, it is hell over there." He feels badly, though. So does Lazarus. They'd like to help him. But Abraham says, "I'm sorry. Turnabout is fair play. You had your luxury. Now it's Lazarus's turn. Besides, we can't get across that chasm, even if we wanted to, and we do. We can't come to you." The rich guy sees it's a lost cause for him, but then he remembers his brothers, his five brothers. Somebody's got to warn them. So once again, he calls out to Abraham, "Hey, what about my brothers? Send Lazarus to warn them so they don't end up here too." Abraham yells back, "Don't worry. They have Moses and the prophets and the Old Testament. It's plain enough what they need to do." The rich guy continues, No. They need something dramatic, like a man coming back from the dead." "Nah," says Abraham. "If they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, they won't even listen to a man who returns to them from the dead." So what's the point? Where do we fit in? We know we're not as rich as the rich guy. As long as there are professional athletes around, we're off the hook on that one. And we know we're not as poor as Lazarus. We don't go to the soup kitchen to eat. So who are we? We are the five brothers, still alive, who still have choices to make about how we respond to the needs of the world around us. Here's where things get personal and difficult. We claim we are Christians in our living, yet we sense a constant temptation to follow the Pharisees and hoard our wealth. We figured we worked hard for it. God has blessed us with it. We have a right to it, to keep it, and grow it. But how come we so often feel a pang of guilt when we pass by someone like my ballpark beggar? I think I am right to say it is not good stewardship to give money to people who will waste it, particularly if they waste it on booze or drugs. Yet that is not the point. The point is this: am I sharing what I have with people in need who will use it wisely? Thank you for the choir's anthem this morning, Lee. We were talking about the serendipitous ways that the anthem, without any effort from us, seems to fit a theme. It did this morning. My glib response to Pete is that I give my money to the church and to agencies that care for the poor. And I do give to things like the Presbyterian Hunger Program, the St. Pete Clinic, to a rural clinic in Honduras, among others. But more than that, what about my whole manner of living? Is my life marked by consumption? Or am I putting back and replacing, making the world a better place than I found it? Am I trying to make the world a fuller place for everyone? What about you? We are the five brothers. Do we hear Moses and the prophets? The law of Moses requires that we share our goods and possessions with the poor and transients. Quote, "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very edges of your field, or gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and alien. I am the Lord your God." These provisions for the poor were made over and above the tithe for the temple. Quote, "You shall open wide your hand to your brother and to the poor and needy in the land." The prophets underlined what the law declared. Speaking for God, Isaiah explained, "Is not this the fast I choose? To let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, cover him, and not hide yourself from your own flesh." Now, Jesus made no attempt to ease up on this. He said, "It is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one dot of the law to become void." You know, like the five brothers, we have heard Moses and the prophets many times. We have heard the teachings of Jesus for a long time, most of us. The five brothers heard the law and the prophets read every week in the synagogue. Those of us who've been in the church for a while, heard them read every week in church and in Sunday school. These five brothers heard them read so often they became immune to them. That is our danger too. Has hearing the scripture, and particularly Jesus, inoculated us from the possibility that we can still be moved by them and even transformed by them? Does the word of the Lord still make a difference in how we see the world and in our living? Jesus makes the point in his parable that it is not that we just listen to what he says, but that we participate in God's redeeming work in this world. This is the story of why we are here, how we are to live, and what we shall be. If we hear Moses and the prophets, we'll discover what Jesus plainly said. One's life does not consist in the abundance of one's possessions. If we listen to Moses and the prophets and Jesus, we will realize the beggar at the gate is our sixth brother. How is a thoughtful 21st century Christian to react to this parable? Well, I want to make some suggestions that may be controversial and may annoy you. I apologize for that, sort of. I want to suggest that we recognize that on an international level, America is the rich guy. And the people of Central America and Mexico are Lazarus at our gate. I have visited Guatemala and Honduras. Each time I was stunned by their poverty. I mean, it is beyond what you could even imagine until you get down there. Ask Joni, she's been in rural Honduras and has seen it on several occasions. My daughter Ina came home from Guatemala and with her youth group organized an offering to raise funds to buy uniforms for Guatemalan children who cannot attend school without them and their parents cannot afford to buy them. That's one way to react. Another is to support the New Hope Clinic in rural Honduras that provides health care for the poorest of the poor. There's countless other ways, equally good and maybe better. It's not for lack of opportunity that the Lazaruses from Central America are not getting our help. At a national level, I think we need to at least recognize the possibility that there is an implicit bias in our country against people of color. Now, sociological studies have proven this over and over again. When you combine that with inner city issues of poor education, it then flows over into economics and the criminal justice system. You know, I have to confess that I was resistant to the whole notion of white privilege until I read America's Original Sin by Jim Wallace. I recommend that to you if you want to contest what I have to say, and you have the right to do that. But until I read that book, and having read it, I recognized myself in his analysis. In many ways, racial minorities and the poor have the deck stacked against them. We can at least recognize that and do what we can to change it. And on a local level, we can support church and civic agencies that reach out to our needy neighbors. Our recent drive to collect undies for the kids is an example of what we can do. The gathering of foodstuffs that we do here and pass along to pantries and so forth is another example. These are good examples and efforts of what we can do, and we know that we can do more. We can mentor and tutor students who need a little extra coaching. We can volunteer at places like the St. Pete Clinic. I only say that because I know about that one. There are plenty of other ones here in Largo and Clearwater that are doing similar things. The opportunities to give and serve are endless. Pick one. And friends, here's the bottom line. Lazarus is all around us, near and far. Jesus' parable says our future depends on how we respond to our Lazaruses. If we understand ourselves as the rich man's five brothers and the poor as our sixth brother, we can address Jesus' hopes for this world. The needs are pressing, near and far. We know what Jesus wants from us. There really is no room for excuses. Amen.